If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Gabriel Bergmoser is a Melbourne-based author and playwright. In 2015, he won the prestigious Sir Peter Ustinov Television Scriptwriting Award for his pilot screenplay based on windmills and was flown to the International Emmys in New York to accept. In 2016, his first young adult novel, Boone Shepherd, was published by Bellfrog Books. It was followed by Boone Shepherd's American Adventure and Boone Shepherd, The Silhouette and The Sacrifice, the final book in the trilogy, was released in 2018. In 2019, Gabriel signed a two-book deal with HarperCollins, with the first, The Hunted, recently published as of last Monday. The Hunted will be published in UK by Faber under the title Sunburnt Country, and the film adaptation is currently being developed in a joint production between Stampede Ventures and Vertigo Entertainment in Los Angeles, with Gabriel writing the screenplay. He has since signed a second two-book deal with Harper for his young adult coming-of-age novel, Nelson and the Gallagher, and a follow-up. So, Gabe, thank you so much for joining me for the third time on The Novel Analyst.
Thanks for having me for the third time. I think it's the first time that I've returned for a third time to any podcast. So,
oh, excellent.
So I guess that's a milestone, but yeah.
Great. Hopefully it will be a better trilogy than The Godfather and the third one.
Yeah.
So
let's hope for the best.
Fingers crossed. So I thought that perhaps we could start talking a little bit about the journey of The Hunted, which is your most recent release. And my first experience with this was the audio drama novella that came out a couple of years ago. And since then, it's become quite a different beast and it has developed a lot since then. So perhaps you could just let people know what The Hunted is about and roughly how that developmental journey came along.
Yeah, so its earliest iteration was the kind of short story novella Sunburnt Country, which was released online as part of my, as sort of a spin-off of my old podcast, Movie Maintenance. I should point out as well, just while I remember, so up until not that long ago, Sunburnt Country was going to be the title of the UK release, but it is actually going to be released under The Hunted in the UK as well.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah. So, Sunburnt Country is the original title of the story. And I guess in terms of pitching the novel as it currently stands as The Hunted, it's a violent, action-packed, pulse-pounding siege thriller set in middle of nowhere Australia. Essentially, it focuses on Frank, a sort of middle-aged roadhouse owner who's currently has his young granddaughter staying with him, doesn't really know how to relate to her. They've got kind of quite an awkward relationship. And then one afternoon, a couple of guests have stopped by the roadhouse. Everybody's sort of hanging around in there. And out of nowhere, this car comes careening up out the front, comes to a halt. A girl steps out covered in mud and blood. And the only thing she says before she passes out is, "Don't call the police," which kicks off a sort of relentless 12-hour really seed story of these characters trying to survive against the people who are pursuing her as they come in. Now, weirdly, this premise in a lot of ways is sort of a sequel to the original short story, Sunburnt Country. So Sunburnt Country focused on Simon, who was a young university student traveling across Australia in search of this kind of esoteric, I guess an esoteric quest to find the real Australia. And along the way, Simon met this girl, Maggie, who he sort of has a bit of a crush on. She asks if she can come with him. They go traveling together. And on her suggestion, he ends up taking a back road that leads him to a town where things are a little bit, understatement of maybe the millennium, a little bit wrong. So I guess the journey as it was that originally I'd had this idea for a long time about a couple of travelers finding a back of beyond town where the townsfolk were not good people and basically kind of were unleashed upon these main characters, and the story was about them trying to survive. And so originally I'd kind of had the idea gestating for a really long time. I eventually wrote it as the horror novella Sunburnt Country in 2017. And what happened was that I found myself falling really in love with the character of Maggie, who is kind of, I guess, in some ways, the inciting incident of the original short story. The protagonist, Simon, does not bode well, or does not fare well in this story. And Maggie kind of takes over about halfway through. But around the point that Maggie took over the story, I found myself kind of enraptured by her. You know, I really wanted to know more about her. I got the sense very early on that there was a lot more to her past than was necessarily evident in that short story. And when she kind of escapes from the town at the end of it, I was left sort of thinking, well, where do you go next? And immediately I had this idea of her turning up bloodied and injured and delusional at this roadhouse. And so for a long time, I was sort of toying with the idea of writing, I guess, a sequel to that novella. But once sort of a little bit of time had passed and I sort of found myself wanting to revisit that story again, the idea of sequelizing a novella that, you know, quite a few people read due to the platform of my old podcast, but less so than I wanted to, the idea of writing a follow-up to that kind of, I guess, lacked appeal, because I sort of was left thinking, well, what's the audience actually going to be for this? Like, is it just people who read the original version? And then when it got to a point where I was no longer associated with the old podcast, it was like, well, how am I even going to release this? How am I even going to get this in front of people? But, you know, I guess my love of Maggie kind of prevailed and I did want to rewrite it. And then I sort of thought, well, what if I merge this with the original novella and make it sort of a longer story? But even that came with its own problems, because the idea of sort of telling this story divided into two very distinct chunks, where about partway through we sort of reset and we have to meet a whole bunch of new characters and set all of them up and essentially have a whole new inciting incident and tell a whole new chunk of the story where none of them are familiar with what happened to Maggie previously, but the audience are familiar. It just sort of looked to me like a very lopsided novel structure. And so I went back and forth for a long time, but then I thought about Christian White's really successful thriller, The Nowhere Child, which came out recently, which unfolds in then and now timelines. So that's a story about a girl who gets told in present day Australia that there is a suspicion that she might in fact be a child who went missing 25 years previously in America. And so she kind of goes back to the town where this girl who could ostensibly have been her went missing to try to delve into her past. And the story unfolds between what happened back then and what's happening in the present day. She delves into her past. And so I thought, well, maybe I can borrow/steal that structure and apply it to this and essentially split up the old novella as flashbacks that are interspersed through the present day timeline. And that way you kind of have those structural story beats playing out in parallel, you know, the inciting incident of Maggie arriving in the roadhouse in the present day. And then the next chapter, you get the inciting incident of Simon meeting her in the pub previously, and then alternating chapters until about the midpoint of the story where the two timelines converge and you sort of have all the necessary information for the story to build up towards its climax. So that was basically what I settled on when I decided to write the next part of the story and write the whole thing as this bigger novel. And so I wrote that, but even then, you know, it only hit about 40,000 words. It wasn't a particularly long book. And I sort of sat on it, I did some edits, and then I sent it to, spoiler alert, my now agent, Tara Winnett Curtis Brown, who had read a couple of things of mine and been sort of, you know, done that very kind agent thing of saying, good, but not quite, good, but not quite. What else do you have? And I sort of sent her what was then still called Sunburnt Country as this last ditch kind of attempt to get over the line. You know, it was completely different to either of the previous things I'd sent her. I thought, okay, look, she's either going to tell me to leave her alone, or she's going to at least see that I have versatility as a writer. And even when I hit send, you know, and I've written this and I've said this before in other interviews, but I genuinely thought the moment I hit send, I was like, there is no way she is going to go for this. You know, it's too violent, it's too weird, it's too short, among other things. But she got back and she was really enthusiastic. And the first thing was that she had some notes about expanding the story to make it a bit longer. So I took those on board. That bulked up to about 50,000 words. I sent it back to her. And even then I thought, okay, so this still isn't going to, I still didn't think it was going to be enough. You know, I didn't think she'd like it. I thought that she'd sort of read the rewrites and say, oh, wow, no, this guy's a hack. He can't write at all. Like, I've given him simple directives that he just hasn't picked up on. And I sort of waited for a few days for her to get back to me. And then she got back saying, all right, I'm going to go out to publishers tomorrow. And I was like, oh, okay. And then the next day she got back to me saying, oh, I've sent this to an agent who we work with in LA, who Jerry Kalajian, who sold Big Little Lies and several other things and has sold quite a few works for Curtis Brown, including The Book Thief he sold. And,
oh, no way.
Yeah, yeah. And not for Curtis Brown, but he also sold, I think, The Wolf of Wall Street and several other like really kind of exciting projects. And anyway, so she told me that she had sent this to Jerry and he wanted to get on a phone call with me. So he gets on a phone call with me. And at the time, I remember my partner and I had traveled up to Canberra to stay with some family of mine. And so next thing, I'm getting all of these phone calls in between us sort of going and visiting, you know, the varied tourist attractions of Canberra. And, you know, I'm not paying attention to any of this, sort of spending time with my family or my girlfriend, because I'm busy kind of replying to all these emails thinking, holy crap, how is any of this happening? And then, yeah, sort of pacing around my aunt's pool in Canberra, sort of on the phone to Jerry, and he's telling me about who he's going to send it to and how excited he is by it and how thrilled he is. And I'm thinking, how is any of this happening? And then next thing, you know, he said that he'd gotten in touch with Roy Lee, you know, who has produced incredible amounts of work. You know, he was, his company Vertigo were behind the It movies, behind Dr. Sleep, which came out recently. Roy was involved in How to Train Your Dragon films and The Disaster Artist and The Ring, which is, you know, one of my all-time favorites. And it's kind of hearing that and then looking over his credits and sort of seeing his enthusiastic email back and thinking, oh, okay, this is mad. And then the way everything kind of escalated from there, it all happened really, really quickly. And it was so strange because in some ways, the process of merging the sequel idea with the novella original and kind of stitching it all together in a way that I hoped was coherent, it was this almost mercenary act that I just thought, okay, this isn't going to work. I finished it and I was like, I don't even know what I have here. Like this weird Frankenstein novel that I have no idea if it's going to remotely land with people. And then it somehow did. And then it somehow led to this ridiculous kind of roller coaster that I've been on ever since. So that was not a nutshell, but that was basically the journey of the hunted to get to now. And then of course it got across the desk of Catherine Milne at HarperCollins, and she called me and she was really enthusiastic, and we had this amazing conversation where she essentially articulated all the things that I saw in the story but maybe were not quite evident yet. And that led to this crazy process. You know, I flew up to Sydney and there were several other publishers in contention as well who made offers on the book, which was completely mad and led to this horrible circumstance of having to say no to some people who would have been amazing publishers for the book as well. But ultimately, it was Catherine's passion for it and the passion from the whole Harper team when I went and met with them that really, you know, made it evident to me that they were the people I had to go with, because they just seemed to totally understand not just the book, but the character of Maggie as well and where I really wanted to go with her.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that process, because it's been so fascinating to like watch, yeah, that progression from, yeah, early audio drama to then you having blog posts out about, oh, you know, I'm thinking about working this thing, and then of course all of the deal stuff, and then it just exploding. And normally with this kind of thing you just get to see the explosion, but it's been really inspiring to see the build up to that from my end. Before we go any further, I should mention that this conversation will contain spoilers for The Hunted, so we are both free to discuss and spoil it liberally. The flashback structure really appealed to me a lot, because I think it's quite a brave decision in a lot of ways to have your kind of tentpole character being Maggie, not really being like awake for a large majority of the main story. How did you strike that good balance between showing the portions that needed to be set in the present timeline versus the past or then timeline in the book?
Yeah, so it was semi necessity and semi accident. So, you know, the moment I knew that I wanted to structure it in that way and convert the old novella version into flashbacks in this, I was also aware of the fact that in the original novella, Maggie is quite a mystery. And for those listening who have read The Hunted, as you probably picked up on, the original novella is the then parts of the story. And in that part, you know, it is a mystery. Simon meets this girl. She's got a bag full of cash. She seems to be on the run from something. She alludes to being homeless, but doesn't really specify where she's come from. And there is this question of who is this girl? Is she dangerous? Is she a threat to him? All of those things sort of turn out to be true in different ways.
Yep.
And you know, there's a risk the moment you employ that kind of structure that in the present day side of the story, you sort of spoil the big questions of the past side of the story. Yes. So it was imperative that Maggie remained a mystery in the present as well. On top of that, it feels so exciting to be able to kind of talk about this book freely now, because I feel like in every interview I've done for the last year, I've been talking around plot points.
Yes.
But, and I still have this instinctive, oh no, don't say that. You're not allowed to say that, but I can. It's so exciting.
Let it alone. So
obviously at the end of the past segment of the story, Maggie is badly injured. She's lost a lot of blood. She's had a trap on her leg. She's been savaged by a dog. You know, she's not doing well. So it made sense that she would be unconscious for a big chunk of the present day thing. Mm. But also for the characters in the Roadhouse, like Frank, Ali, Charlie, Delilah, you know, that to me is what created the real drama of it. You know, you've got this girl, she turns up on your doorstep, she collapses, she's bleeding, she says, don't call the police. And then a bunch of bad guys turn up and they're out to get her and she's unconscious. She can't speak for herself. She can't tell them where she's come from. They don't know anything about her apart from that she's in huge trouble. And that creates a moral dilemma for them where they're like, well, we can hand her over and hope that these guys will leave us alone, or we can protect her not knowing what she's done or if she even deserves what these guys are trying to put her through.
Mm.
So it kind of worked to my benefit that the moment I divided the story that way, I was able to retain the mystery in past and present, because in the past you're thinking, where's this girl come from? In the present, you're thinking, what's this girl been through? And in both versions, up until about, you know, the midpoint of the story, you really don't know if she's a good guy or a bad guy. You really don't know what her agenda is or what she's trying to achieve. And then even when you do sort of find out, there remains a certain degree of moral ambiguity surrounding her and surrounding the choices she makes. It's not really until we see her perspective that we realize that she is somebody who feels remorse. She is somebody who, you know, feels very deeply about the mistakes that she's made. She's somebody who is trying and struggling to do the right thing. And she's somebody who has a huge amount of demons of her own that she's grappling with. I'm not saying that justifies any of the things that she does in the book, because she has some questionable decisions she makes, but I sort of then realized almost by accident, the midpoint of the story, you know, with a midpoint traditionally being the moment where either the gravity of the situation becomes clear or a truth is revealed to the audience. The midpoint becomes the moment where you sort of understand not only the depth of trouble that the characters are in terms of what these townspeople are capable of, but also who Maggie is. That she is this sort of quasi-vigilante, on-the-run, dangerous anti-hero type who is ultimately, when all is said and done, for all of her actions and choices, on the side of the angels. So yeah, it really ended up lining up by accident, but I kind of had that nice dovetail where around the point in the book where the flashbacks end is the point in the book where Maggie wakes up. And so by that point, as an audience, you're hopefully more or less caught up with everything you need. And then the rest of the book doesn't have anything left to reveal. It's just a relentless pulse pounding sort of, I keep using that phrase pulse pounding, but you know, a relentless roller coaster ride to the finish line.
Yeah. And I think it builds to a really great payoff as well when she finally wakes up and like starts doing the action stuff in the second half of the book. I think is the first scene we see when she wakes up, is that the one where she like goes in and blasts like Reg's head apart with the shotgun?
Yes,
that's it.
And that scene was so much fun, because even the structure of that was tricky, because for that to be satisfying, you know, we sort of need to know ultimately what a badass she is, right?
Yes.
So I made sure that that came after we've seen her in the bush kind of taking out all of the hunters one by one. You know, we've already seen her kill Kev in the shed with the hook through the jaw, which all the European covers are loving. They've all got the hook somehow.
Yeah, I've seen that with the covers. It's amazing.
They all love the hook. Great. The hook just keeps like the I can't name the person just yet, but the director of the film, I keep sending them texts of all the covers coming in. And it's funny because there was a point where the hook might have been removed from the screenplay. And he keeps kind of getting back to me being like, wow, they love that hook in Europe. And I'm like, they absolutely love that hook in Europe. And ergo, I'm vindicated in the hook staying.
Yeah,
the hook absolutely had to stay. But yeah, so, you know, we've then gotten to see Maggie kind of go through the forest. She's taken out Matty, Caden, and Steve. And so we now know how capable she is. And so that hopefully creates a sense of catharsis when Ali's being threatened by Reg in the house, and Reg kind of has her up against the wall. And then that moment that I loved writing, where Reg is like, "Where's Maggie?" And then you just hear from behind him, "She's right here," turns around, she clocks him in the face with the shotgun, spins around, blows his head off. And to me, that's a moment where, like, I'm hoping if I've done my job right, you're punching the air and you're being like, "Yes, go." And now, like, now, you know, she's woken up, she's there to fight, she's joining them. And I got to put in all of those super fun cinematic moments, like when the bad guys kind of realize that she's in the house behind the roadhouse, and there's a bit where she's framed in the door with, you know, all the headlights kind of coming towards her, and she's holding a shotgun. And I'm like, if that's not a poster shot, I don't know what is. But, you know, it's so many
cinematic moments. It's great. Like, it's going to make an amazing film.
It's designed to be cinematic. Like, it was first conceived as a film, you know? Mm-hmm. So all of those really visual, I mean, I don't want to say iconic, because that sounds like I'm kind of getting way ahead of myself. But like, moments designed to have that sort of visually striking quality, yes, were all kind of threaded in there right from the start, you know?
Yeah, and it definitely comes across, and especially in the action sequences. Because what I found great about this, I should preface this with saying that I haven't read a huge amount of thrillers before, but what made this book stand out a lot for me, amongst the depth of characterization and the complexity with the characters you follow, was the action scenes, because you give such simple ingredients to the characters. It's not a story where, you know, they're in like a skyscraper and there's helicopters going around and bazookas or anything that's like ridiculously high tech or anything, which can be its own kind of fun. But you just give us these very simple ingredients of, like, it's a roadhouse, there's some petrol there, there's cars, you know, there's some rope maybe, and like some basic guns. And from that, you create such like unique executions on those ideas that, like, I personally haven't read anywhere before. Like an example I think I mentioned in my review of this was where they are like having two characters standing off. One is sort of hiding behind a car. Another one has a car maybe 50 meters away or so. And then they drop a brick on the accelerator to make the car look like it's being driven towards the other vehicle. And the character shoots at the vehicle. Vehicle doesn't stop, and it's because there's no one in there. And it's just these really simple things, which, yeah, I really like the creativity behind that. So I was wondering if you could just discuss a little bit about how you blocked out those action sequences, to what extent you like brainstormed creative ways of using materials, or was it like, oh, I want this thing to happen, I'm going to go back and add these materials in for that to be the case?
It's a little A, little B, I guess, is probably the way to put it. Like, it's one of those things where around the time that I was really working on The Hunted, I had started reading the Ripley books by Patricia Highsmith, so The Talented Mr. Ripley and its sequels. And one thing that I really loved in The Talented Mr. Ripley was how it's essentially a book about problem solving. Like, in a weird, messed up way, it's a book about a character who, you know, he's the definition of an anti-hero. I mean, he's really a villain when all is said and done. But so much of that book is this character ending up in situations where you're like, there is no way he's going to get out of this. And then reading the creative ways that he does manage to get out of the really kind of difficult corners he finds himself in. And that also, that quality is something that I've always been really inspired by in two of my all-time favorite TV shows, which are very linked, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. And famously, Vince Gilligan has always said that the writing process of Breaking Bad was, a lot of it was, we will write our characters into the most difficult situations we can think of, and then we'll have to write our way out of it, using only what the characters would have available at the time. And I kind of think that that style of writing has become perfected in Better Call Saul, because so much of Better Call Saul is just impossible situations and the characters coming up with really innovative ways to get out of it. And it creates this really organic build of story where, because the solutions are realistic and imperfect solutions, they tend to end up resulting in more problems down the line and more complications. But also they tend to be really surprising, because they're not solutions that necessarily are brought about because there's a really obviously placed Chekhov's gun. They're solutions that have been brought about because they're thinking, okay, so five episodes earlier, we had this plot point happen. What if that character from that plot point is who they call at this moment to make this thing happen, and so on and so forth. So in writing a lot of the scenes in The Hunted, I kind of challenged myself to do something really similar. So I didn't plan any of it out hugely in huge detail. I always knew there was going to be the roadhouse. I always knew that Maggie was going to turn up there. I always knew that there was going to be a siege. But beyond that, you know, when I started writing, I didn't really know much more than that. And So consequently, things like the moment where Frank blows up the roadhouse when the bad guys are trying to sort of pour petrol underneath his door with the fuel nozzles, and he lights it on fire and then runs out and it all blows up and blows them away. That was something where I just sort of thought about, and I was like, well, okay, so they're in a roadhouse. The bad guys are probably going to use the petrol to try to get him, right? And then if he turns that back on them, and I sort of thought about it and I went through it for a few different angles. I was like, okay, no, that makes sense. And then other moments like Maggie, when she improvises the Molotov cocktail to throw it out there, I was like, okay, so we've set up from the start that the bad guys have canisters of fuel because they're going to try to burn the house down at the end. And they've been threatening that all the way through. So, okay, they're going to have those there, and that's naturally going to be there. And also in the town, she references all the utes around the place with like the bricks in the back or the tarps or whatever else. So that was how the brick kind of came into it. And having grown up in the country, you know, I saw a lot of those sort of utes around the place with just piles of bricks in the back. Were the guys tradies? Were they using the bricks to kill people? I don't know. But, you know, that's kind of where, you know, anyone who's grown up in the country has seen those cars and those trays and just random assortments of objects in the back, and, you know, the cars with cranes on the back and all those kinds of things. So ultimately, it was one of those just beautiful accidents where, as I went on, I sort of realized, well, all of these things are going to be present, and all of them can ultimately be used as tools that can result in somebody's violent death. And that lines up beautifully with everything this book sort of is exhibiting. So yeah, it was sort of partly little things that I set up and I was like, okay, well, I can pay that off. And it was partly just sort of looking back and thinking, oh, cool, well, there is a brick here and there is a hook here and there is petrol here, and that would make sense. And so I sort of was trying my best to do that Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul thing without a room of writers around me to kind of help me find those moments. And I did sort of stumble on a few moments that I really liked, and it helped me unlock a key aspect of Maggie's character, which is that she's a problem solver. And that's why she has that mantra where she's always saying, what do I have? What do I have? What do I have? And that's something that keeps coming up, because every time she ends up cornered in a situation, her first thought is, what do I have and how do I use it?
Yeah. And that kind of like sets up, once you've done that a couple of times, there's a good sort of trigger effect in my mind as a reader, because you know that like something cool is going to happen next.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I was going for, which is awesome to hear.
And also even in the, like the excerpt for The Inheritance, book two at the end of it, that's how the prologue or chapter one for that ends, I think, is what do I have?
Kind of like, yeah.
Sets that off.
And that was the funny thing was, in the original draft of The Inheritance, that line wasn't in there. But then it was Catherine at Harper who sort of had said, make that a mantra for her, make that keep coming up. And then so when I was asked to provide the excerpt of The Inheritance for the end of this book, I was looking at it, and originally, because that's only about half of the currently written first chapter that appears at the end of The Hunted. And at half, they were like, it's probably going to be a bit of a shorter excerpt. So I cut it down to halfway. And then I realized it was a perfect moment there to have Maggie say, what do I have? Which is going to be in the actual book as well. But I just sort of thought, all right, if you've read The Hunted and you've kind of, as you're saying, have understood the shorthand of what that means, because it means Maggie's about to do something awesome, in my mind anyway, then I can put that there and sort of leave that as an effective teaser that can make the audience hopefully go, oh, cool, she's going to do something to get out of this situation.
Speaking of awesome, in quite a few interviews, you've mentioned that there's one specific moment in the book that you were afraid was going to be too extreme for some publishers or readers. But much to your pleasure, it stayed in the book. And I'm wondering if you could reveal what that moment is.
I would love to see if you can guess.
Okay, let's do it.
Yeah,
well, I think it's a toss-up between either the hook scene where we get the reveal that the town has been hunting humans down and then like stringing them up in this shed and cutting bits off them. That's one. But then I feel like that's maybe too obvious, and that the second one is when Maggie is trapped in the house. You have all of the characters surrounding her. The person goes in to negotiate with her, and then that same person comes out a few minutes later, covered in blood, carrying Maggie's shotgun, and you think as a reader, oh no, like, Maggie's dead. Did Gabe do this? Surely not. And then the reveal is that she skinned that character and is wearing her face and her clothes to disguise herself as she comes out. So,
yes, it's the scalping. The scalping is the moment. And the funny thing, because the scalping was one of those moments that was one of those problem-solving accidents where I thought, all right, I'm at this point, I'm in the third act of the story, they're stuck in the house, this is a stalemate, and realistically, I'm sitting there thinking, all right, how long, I say realistically for a book that's about a town full of hunters holding this place to siege, but anyway, I sort of sat there and I thought, okay, so how long are these guys going to put up with this? Because so many of them have died by now, and the credibility the idea that they want to torture and make Maggie suffer and that that would be important to them, I think holds water, but only to a certain point. Because once about like 10, 15 of them have died, they're going to say, okay, enough is enough. We're just killing everyone and we're going to burn this place down. And, you know, whether she's alive or dead, it doesn't matter. We just want her gone. So it got to this point where I was like, okay, they're not going to wait much longer. And this was one of those happy accidents where the character of Kate, who ends up on the receiving end of Maggie's knife and ends up providing Maggie's escape wig, Kate was a character
such a
who
way of putting it.
Did, yeah. Kate was a character who did not appear in the original novella, but she was a character I had in my head for a while. Like, I really love this idea that Steve, who is the sort of young head hunter in the past, who Maggie ends up blowing his leg off with a shotgun and then killing him with a cricket bat. I love the idea that Steve had this equally violent, equally bloodthirsty girlfriend who was sort of jealous of Maggie. And I kind of had that in my head when I was writing the original version, but because it was only a 15,000 word novella and there was a lot to get through, she just never really made an appearance. And so consequently, a lot of these characters who I'd sort of thought of in the town got to sort of make their appearance when I was writing the scenes at the roadhouse, at the house and the siege scenes, because they hadn't appeared and they retroactively made their appearances in the flashbacks in the redrafting process. But Kate was one of those characters, you know, I'd had her in my head for a long time. And then when I came to merging the two halves of the story, I thought, okay, well, I can go back and I can thread her through the scenes in the town so that Maggie and Simon can introduce her. And so I can set her up. And I'd always sort of thought of her as this waifish character with this blonde hair that's always kind of hanging in her face. And you can only ever see one eye shining through because, you know, she's like madness incarnate and she delights in blood and death and in violence. And she's pretty much the worst of all of the townspeople. And so consequently towards the end, I was like, that idea of the skinniest, most harmless looking member of the town being the most dangerous was also something that was a nice thematic parallel with Maggie. Mm. But then at the end, when it came to getting them out of that stalemate, I thought, well, who are they going to send to the house? Of course, they're going to send Kate into the house. And of course, Kate is going to turn the tables and try to kill Allie and try to sort of do her thing. And then when I sort of thought about how's Maggie going to get out of that situation, my mind goes back to one of my all-time favorite films, which is The Silence of the Lambs, and to the bit where Hannibal Lecter escapes custody by wearing a policeman's face. I'm thinking, well, here's a nice little dovetail, because I've constantly talked about how big Kate's hair is, and Maggie's sort of from this dodgy background where she's been hunting and she's been through a situation where she would have to skin animals. And I thought, it's a great moment to show to the audience and to everyone that Maggie is a character who will always go a step beyond what we would assume is acceptable.
Yes.
Like, she's not, that's the key thing about Maggie, is that she's not a hero. She is somebody who genuinely comes from a place of the ends justify the means. If I have to kill this girl, scalp her, and wear her hair to get out of this situation, I am going to do exactly that. So the reason I was worried about it in terms of would it get past the publishers was not so much because of the violence or the gore of it, because I think it, you know, it's ultimately comparable to everything else that's been in the book so far. And also the very same concept was seen in Silence of the Lambs 30 years ago, but it was more because can we get away with our hero doing this? And I strongly believe, well, yes, because she needs to get out of the situation. She has to survive. Like, it's not something that any normal person might think of, but then of course, if you're backed into that corner, maybe you would think of that. And it's a totally a last ditch, crazy attempt to escape that might not work, but ultimately does. And it's the kind of thing that only a mind like Maggie's that is capable of adopting the perspective of her antagonists would kind of be capable of settling on. And so I kind of went into all of my meetings with publishers really ready to fight for that scene, because to me, it's so crucial to defining who she is and what her character is all about. And to me, it's like, and I know that like several reviewers now have compared Maggie in some ways to Lisbeth Salander from the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo books, which is a hugely flattering. But beyond that, it's also one of those things where I always remember reading those books and thinking, why does Lisbeth never get to kill the bad guys? Like, you know, she's tough, she's violent, she's all of those things. And yet there seems to be this hesitation when it comes to her really finishing off the villains. Whereas we have no question about Clint Eastwood doing that. We have no question about Bruce Willis doing that. We have no question about any male anti-heroes doing that. And yet, for whatever reason, it feels like there's a squeamishness when it comes to having a woman do those things. And I was just like, screw that. I'm going to have Maggie do like far more messed up things than any of these guys and be totally okay with it. Like, and there's that scene right after where she's escaping and she's drenched in Kate's blood and she's screaming, but not in fear, because part of her likes this. Like she has this animalistic quality, and there is this element of her where this savage violence and rage that she keeps inside her, that she is like a superpower that she can unleash at key moments. She's finally kind of succumbing to it. And there should be a question in the audience's mind of like, is that a good thing or not? You know, is it okay that she's succumbing to the animal side of her? And ultimately, well, yes, it is, because that's the only thing that's going to get her out of the situation. So for me, weirdly, apart from just being a grindhouse, gory, horrifying moment, the scalping was essential to the character's journey and to the book. And luckily, everybody I met with got it. There was not a single moment of resistance from anyone, which kind of surprised me, but I think people understood how key it was.
Yeah, and I definitely think it distinguishes her from a lot of your other thriller protagonists who would go to a lot of extents to get out of a situation, but wouldn't necessarily go to, you know, like a gory extent that she has.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
That is really good. You mentioned that The Silence of the Lambs was a bit of an influence on that scene, and I definitely picked that up in a good way, although I think yours takes it even more extreme than what Hannibal Lecter does, which is nice. You also mentioned that some of Springsteen's work was a slight influence on perhaps more of the introspective scenes within the book. I'm not sure if you remember, but I think you put out a tweet a while ago saying that Western Stars, Springsteen's latest album, kind of influenced some of the more contemplative scenes in the novel.
So,
yeah, let's talk about that.
There was one scene that didn't actually make the final cut. So
okay.
It was written after the first round of editorial from HarperCollins. And I'm really hoping that one day I'll be given the license to kind of put it on a blog or something, because I really loved it. But ultimately, I totally understood from an editorial standpoint why it couldn't be in there. But it's a scene, I had it placed in the very final chapter of the book, right after, you know, Trent's dead and Frank and Ali and Maggie are kind of recuperating and sort of wrapping their head around what the hell they've been through. And Frank has this flashback where he talks about a couple of weeks before the events of the book, where he'd been stuck alone in the roadhouse for so long. And of course, part of Frank's arc is that he's a recovering alcoholic. You know, he's sort of put the booze behind him and he's put all of that behind him. But as you see in the book, there's like one dusty bottle of liquor in the cellar that Maggie later on finds and that Frank sort of has there as this like last minute, you know, if I can turn back to it if I need to. But I had that almost more literal in the original draft, where there's a flashback scene where Frank drives into the nearest town, which is still about an hour away. And he sort of drives in there and he drives up to the pub and he sits outside the pub and he just stares at it. And then he goes into the pub and he orders a pint and he sits there and he's looking at the pint and he looks up and the bartender smiles at him. And then he realizes he can't drink this, even though she has no idea who he is, but he can't do it. And he puts the pint back and he walks out and he kind of stands outside and he's sort of shaking. Then he turns left and he goes to the bottle shop and he buys a bottle of Jack Daniels and he drives home with it sitting on his chair. And then he puts it in the kitchen cupboard and he sits there and he just can't decide what to do with it. And he is like back and forth on whether or not to drink it. And then he pours himself a glass and he's sitting there ready to drink it. And then he puts it down, sits back, and as he puts it down, sits back, that's when the phone rings. It's his son saying, "Can you take Allie?" So as I was writing that scene, which to me was giving this real insight into sort of how on the edge Frank is, because to me, Frank is a character who in a different life could have been one of the hunters. You know, he's somebody who came from not the same background. He wasn't in a town that was hunting people for sport, but he was in a town where that particular brand of violent Australian toxic masculinity was very much on display, and he turned away from it and he was basically made a pariah because of it. And his choice to turn away from the violence and the drink and all of the toxic things that characterize his youth has only resulted in his complete isolation from the rest of the world. And now after years, he's sitting here thinking, what's the point? Like, what is the point of any of this? I'm just sitting here and I've got no one, no one cares about me, no one loves me. And I'm not drinking to prove a point to myself more than anyone else, but I'm not getting anything out of it. And that the melancholy of that character, because I've known a lot of people like Frank growing up, and I've known a lot of people who are close to my age who are well on the way to becoming Franks, you know? And I really wanted to kind of give that insight into that moment for him of really reaching like the end of his tether. And as I was writing it, the song that scored it for me was a song called Chasing Wild Horses from Springsteen's new album from Western Stars. And so if you've listened to Western Stars, you'll know that it is essentially an album about about getting older, about the regrets of the past, about reaching a place in your life where you've realized that most of your life is behind you and that the mistakes that you made when you were younger that you didn't really think anything of at the time have really come to poison your existence now. And to think back and be like, was it worth it? You know, should I have done that then? Should I have made a change then? Is it too late to make a change now? And all of those themes that he articulates so beautifully in the stories that he tells in that album. And the song Chasing Wild Horses, which basically is about a man who isolates himself from the world because of the danger that he poses to himself and to the people that he loves. And it's one of, I think, Springsteen's most beautifully written song, at least from a lyrical imagery perspective. But I just found there to be something so moving about that song that to me summed up everything that I saw in the Frank character. And I listened to that on repeat as I was writing not only that scene, but a lot of the rewrites. And that song kind of became the soundtrack to the Frank half of the story. And I mean, Western Stars in general, that came out around the time that I was doing a lot of the edits and rewrites of The Hunted. And that album sort of became an unofficial soundtrack to The Hunted. And it was really cool. When I was in LA a few months ago, I flew over for meetings with a lot of the team behind the film. And night I was there, sorry?
Do you mean the Western Stars film or just the
The meetings with people behind The Hunted film. And night I was there, Western Stars had just come out in the US. So my first night in LA, I got off the plane, hung around with my friend Dan, who I was over there with, hanging around Hollywood Boulevard until we could get to our Airbnb, dropped everything off, slept for an hour. And then we went to the Chinese theater and we watched Western Stars. And it was like the coolest, it just felt so right, you know, to watch the film of the album that had been such a huge part of The Hunted before I had a week of meetings about The Hunted, you know, and about its next steps. So absolutely, you know, that album, but specifically that one song, Chasing Wild Horses, was huge for me in terms of capturing the tone I really wanted to capture for Frank's part of the story, at least.
Yeah, now that you've mentioned that, I'll see if I can edit that song into this episode, actually. But that makes total sense. And I can definitely see how that kind of, like encapsulates sort of the themes that is running through Frank's character. And I suppose that is a good segue to just talking about some of the secondary characters, because I suppose Frank is really the main character of this book. But one of the big strengths of this is that none of the other characters that are trapped in the roadhouse, while they don't always get the same amount of screen time as Maggie or Frank, they all feel very well developed and they all feel like they have arcs and things that they're struggling with and processing in their own lives. How do you develop secondary characters that feel necessary for the story and feel like they are actual people and not just there to support a role?
There was a great, I think the term that I keep thinking of, and I don't think it's perfectly applicable in terms of this instance, but the term I kept thinking of was one from a review I read years ago of one of the George A. Romero zombie films. And I think the term it used was something along the lines of Romero is very good at establishing character through thumbnails. And it was sort of just adding those little anchors that would make the characters feel more real, or little things that was just like some small thing they're dealing with or whatever. And so when it came to doing the next pass over the book, whereas in the first draft, a lot of the characters were largely serviceable, I wanted to make sure that Delilah had something she was grappling with, that Frank had something he was grappling with, that Greg had something he was grappling with. And naturally, all of that tied back to this central theme of not only Australian identity, but Australian masculine identity. Mm. Because ultimately, that's what I think the book was about. In its original version as Sunburnt Country, it was unquestionably a sort of satirical look at the Aussie larrikin identity. You know, the idea of what is the real Australia? Is it the beer-swilling, g'day mate larrikin? And if so, is that a good thing? Not answering yes or no, but it was sort of a dark spin on an answer to that question, I guess, in some ways. But in broadening it into a novel, I think the theme had to go deeper and had to find more nuance. And it was really Catherine at Harper who helped me delve deeper and interrogate these questions of like what it means to be an Australian male. Because there is, particularly if you've grown up in the country, which I did, there is a real expectation of what an Aussie bloke is supposed to be. And if you don't fit within those parameters in certain parts of this country, you will be roundly rejected. I certainly was by certain circles in my high school. And a lot of where this book comes from has come from those younger experiences. And so I wouldn't say that it was entirely intentional that every character's arc or demon somehow tied back to that, but it was probably a happy accident in a lot of ways. I mean, like Charlie, like the two characters who I personally relate to the most, funnily enough, are Charlie and Simon. Because Simon basically is a character who I wrote as me. Like, what would I be like on this road trip? And I've said in other interviews before, like, how as a teenager, I always wanted to do the Kerouac road trip, but was never brave enough to actually do it. So Simon was written almost explicitly as, how would I act in this situation? And like, beat for beat, everything about him. Like, if I met a girl like Maggie, if she told me to turn off at this road, if I went to this town and met these hunters, you know, I like to think that I'd be braver or I'd stand up for myself more. But in reality, you know, we always are never quite as cool and collected and badass as we like to hope we are in our own heads and imaginations. So there was something like a bit expository about that and sort of, you know, showing off my insecurities about the kind of guy I would be put in that horrible situation. But also, you know, in the case of Charlie's character, is somebody who wants so desperately to be, you know, he wants his girlfriend Delilah to be proud of him. He wants to be somebody who makes the right calls. He wants to be somebody who is brave, who stands up to injustice, who does the right thing. And yet he's perpetually terrified that he is not that. And that is one of the things that sort of leads to his undoing at the end, because he runs off to save Delilah, but leaves Allie to her fate. And that to me partly stems from this fact that, you know, we wouldn't have those insecurities if there wasn't this overpowering narrative from certain subsets of society about what an Australian man should be like. And these are characters who feel beholden to being in line with that template, often to their detriment. And Frank, in a lot of ways, is the same thing. Frank is somebody who walked away from that and has suffered because of it. And, you know, that's the thing. If often in any society, if you turn away from the accepted way of doing things or the way of doing things that is assumed normal, then people can turn on you very, very quickly, because to reject that sort of thing can be seen by a lot of people as an indictment of their way of life, and people don't take very kindly to that. So all of them were sort of, and then of course, Maggie is somebody who was victimized and was on the receiving end of that violent Australian machismo. All of them sort of had a little bit of that to them. So once I sort of found that that was the anchor of the book and that that tied into all of their kind of demons in different ways, then that really, really helped me anchor all the characters and really find what was at the heart of all of them and hopefully elevate the book above just a gore fest where people just die violently and horribly and there's no unifying theme or no central reason. I mean, and Greg McRae, you know, who's the businessman character who turns up and ends up selling them out to the bad guys and sort of has his beat of redemption at the end, which he doesn't really earn because he still screwed them all over badly. Even his whole insecurity is this idea of having lived his whole life, assuming that he was an alpha male, and then finding himself in a situation where he's gotten older, he's vulnerable, he's going through a midlife crisis, and he's seeing the younger generation literally coming up to take what he has away from him, and he doesn't know how to react to that, and he's drunkenly lashed out and made a fool of himself, and in the process kind of created this awful self-fulfilling prophecy where all of his fears of failure and all of his fears of being an embarrassment and a disappointment have all come true because of his own actions and because of his own inability to just be comfortable with who he is and where he is in life. And, you know, I always believe that insecurity, arrogance, I always believe that I think arrogance, anger, often violence tends to usually stem from insecurity. And that I think is something that's boiling at the heart of a lot of these characters, even in the middle of this pulpy grindhouse story.
I think it's very interesting how people tend to separate a story being entertaining and a story being about something thematically important. And for me, it's always been not really the case. I found that my favorite stories are both entertaining and thematically pertinent because they fuse those two things into one narrative. And it has a layer of depth to it that is, like you say, beyond just the obvious. This is suspenseful, this is pacey, but it's actually also about something as well. So I really like that aspect of it.
It is interesting because like I've never really understood that perceived divide either. Like the idea that for something to have literary merit or for something to be saying something challenging or interesting or valuable, it can't be also a slice of, you know, really gripping entertainment, because I do think the best stories, I mean, look at Jaws, right? Like Jaws is a film that is designed basically, I mean, it's the quintessential prototypical summer blockbuster. It is an engine designed purely to entertain. And yet over the last few weeks with everything's been happening with COVID and everything, if you watch Jaws in the context of everything that's been going on for the last few months, holy crap, that film is pertinent. that film has so much to say about human nature and about the way that we react in the face of fear, and particularly the way that we react in the face of threats that we can't see that are still impeding our lifestyle somehow. It's so interesting how, like, that film, there is something really true and really, like, powerful in what that film is saying about human nature that is still wrapped up in this completely riveting thriller at the same time. And you know, so one thing I'm starting to believe more and more as I'm developing my craft more and more is that no matter what your story is, whether it's something that is autobiographical, real, a dark drama, whatever, or a pulpy thriller or a science fiction or a fantasy or whatever, is that there has to be some element of truth. Like, even if it's just a single line or a single thought or a single moment, there has to be something that comes from you as a human being, something that reflects either something you're grappling with, something you believe passionately, something that is important to you. And to find that heart and that truth in your story is, in a lot of ways, the most important thing that will make sure that your story has value and your story can mean something. Because I really do believe that specificity breeds universality. Like, if you have something in a story that is specific to you, it will be specific to somebody else, because ultimately all of our lived experiences aren't as unique as we like to think they are. There is somebody else on the planet. There are probably millions of people on the planet who are going through the same demons that you think only you are grappling with. And ultimately, fiction is a way of putting those demons out in the world and connecting with other people who share the same thing and saying, hey, you're not the only one, you know? Mm. And that's why I think it is so important to find that whatever it is, that glimmer of the genuine at the heart of any story that you're telling, no matter what genre that story is.
One of the things that's really come across in what you've just been saying is how self-aware you are. And this has definitely been a thing I've noticed with your blog post as well. And I'm curious as to what extent you think writing has helped you develop your self-awareness, or to what extent it has been sort of a manifestation of your self-awareness.
That's a really good question and a really hard one to answer at the same time. I think writing can impede self-awareness sometimes, but at the same time, it can help it. Like, it's a weird one, because I think if you live predominantly in stories and in fiction, which a lot of the times in my life I have done and I'm still guilty of doing, you can miss the obvious about, you know, your own behavior, or you can get so wrapped up in things that aren't real that you don't pay enough attention to what is real. But on the other hand, I think that a developed writer is always in conversation with who they are as a human being and with their journey as a human being. And, you know, even when you are writing about characters who seem a million miles away from you, you're usually in some way writing about yourself. I think the key to it is to identify that. You know, when I was younger and I was writing a lot, I didn't really think about the ways in which the characters were me or were reflective of me. I was just thinking about writing, and I would get caught up in the stories. And I think in some ways that impeded self-interrogation or self-awareness or whatever. Whereas when you sort of realize that you are ultimately writing about yourself and your experiences and your feelings and your beliefs, and you become more attuned to finding where those aspects are slipping into your stories, I think that helps self-awareness, and that does help you kind of hold yourself to account and always try to hold yourself in perspective. And I think as well, you know, part of me is always aware of the fact that writing as a career is inherently ridiculous, because you're just making up stuff that never actually happened, and you're putting that on the page and you're really hoping that somebody will pay you for your strange, fantastical ramblings. It's like when you're a kid and you're making up stories to entertain your friends, or you're playing, you know, cops and robbers or whatever it is, and you're coming up with whole epic narratives around characters you're playing and stuff. But it's like putting that on paper and asking people to pay for it and to think that it's worthwhile. And that's why, you know, it's that simultaneous thing where, for everything that I say about truth and about reaching out to other people in the world and all of that, and I do believe that, I also believe that at the end of the day, you're making stuff up. Don't take yourself that seriously. What you're doing doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. Like, I mean, it does, and it will to some people if you've done it well. But, you know, I think my fundamental belief of what you should bear in mind as a writer is probably something along the lines of, nobody in the world needs to hear your story. You know, don't listen to people when they say people need to hear your story, because they don't. No one needs to hear your story. But if you tell it well enough, people might want to. And that's kind of the thing we all should be aspiring to, I think.
That is good. I'm going to have to write that down as a quote somewhere. That is great. What questions have you been dying for people to ask you about The Hunted that haven't come up in interviews? Whether because they are spoilery or just because they haven't been very well noticed aspects of the book. Is there anything that you think has been overlooked or perhaps looked at differently from how you were expecting?
That's a really good question. Not that many people have asked me about the violence or the degree of the violence, which is interesting. There have been, now that the book is out, at least in digital reviews are starting to come in on both Goodreads and on various blogs. I was really enjoying this book. It was a 5-star read until the midway point, and then it just became torture porn or splatter porn or whatever else they want to call it. And yeah, I don't think there's been that much interrogation of that or that many questions about that particular choice. The problem is I feel like I'm throwing myself under the bus here because I don't necessarily know that I have a really good answer for it, apart from the fact that I've always been really influenced by kind of classic horror and by the ability of horror to kind of push the envelope, but also sneak interesting, pertinent points about humanity under the artifice of blood and gore and violence and all of that. The decision to kill off Simon, I probably would have expected a bit more interrogation of, because that was a really hard scene to write, particularly because in the earliest version of the story, you didn't see it. You know, you saw him get pulled out of the car, you saw them about to kill him. And that was where I left it for ages until Catherine Milne said to me, well, I think we need to see the hunters. For a book called The Hunted, we need to see them hunt him.
Yes.
And she was like, the only real place to put that is for them to hunt Simon. And I'm seeing, and like one thing, I will come back to this other point in one sec, so I'm just going to put a pin in that. But like, one thing that was really important to me was that we never see the perspectives of the hunters. I mean, the book's written in limited third person, but I never wanted to put anyone in the minds of any of the hunters. I wanted only to see the minds of our central characters. So that meant that seeing Simon get hunted could only happen from Simon's perspective. And the prospect of writing a character who knows he's going to die and is trying to run away and the whole thing's totally futile and he's being made a mockery and a game for these horrible people, particularly a character who is basically me, was something that gave me this like really visceral, horrible feeling that I was like, I don't want to write that. And that means I absolutely have to write that. You know, if I'm running away from it, then how can I expect to put the audience through the ringer if I'm not going to put myself through it? So I really went back and forth on how to write that scene. And then I sort of thought, it's going to be a fool's errand if I try to specifically write everything that's happened to him physically. So I tried to plant the scene entirely in his thoughts and in this sort of fractured half dream, half reality, sort of trauma, absolute terror, miasma of merged experience that he's going through at the time. And I'm really proud of that scene, I think, for that reason. And, you know, the other thing is, it's interesting because that question of perspective, just to quickly riff off this, because I do think it is something worth discussing, has been really interesting when it has come to adapting it into a film. And that's probably the other thing that I probably haven't had that many questions about, is like the experience of actually taking this story and somehow transitioning it into a totally different medium and yet trying to retain the heart of it, because so much of that introspection you can't really have in film, or not in the same way, unless you want the characters to stop and deliver massive monologues about all of their inner demons, which you can't really get away with.
Would feel a little bit contrived if, yeah, as someone is driving away from people trying to hunt them down, they're like slipping back into some monologue about, and I knew the bottle was waiting in the cellar for me all along.
But I mean, that's like, you know, I mentioned the character of Greg before, and Greg has been an unfortunate casualty of the adaptation process, because he's one of those characters who exists in the book partly to underline the theme, but also partly to provide our eyes in the enemy camp. You know, like he exists too, because he sells out the main characters partway through. And then for the rest of the book, he's sort of there in the enemy camp. And he's essentially there to give eyes to what Trent and Janice and Kate and all the others are doing. But in the film, you don't need that, because you can just show whatever you want to show. And so in the very first draft, I cut Greg, and then the team behind it were like, we actually want Greg back. So I was like, okay. So I kind of went back to the screenplay and I threaded Greg back into it. And then when the director came on board, he was like, I think we need to cut Greg. Why is Greg even in this? And I was like, well, I believe he had a reason for being in it in the book, but in the film he didn't. So he's gone. And then there's a few other changes, but I don't want to spoil too much about what's going to be in the film, because it's going to be a fairly faithful adaptation. But there's what I will say is that a lot of the deaths that have upset people in the book are a lot more violent in the film, like a way, way more messed up in the movie than they are in the book. So that's one thing. And Yeah, the other thing is that it's been interesting because, you know, you've got to try to find different ways of articulating Frank's. So in the film, Frank is explicitly a war veteran. So that, which was actually part of his character trait in the very first draft of the book.
I remember but you talking about that on a podcast.
Yeah, so that was sort of a way to give him, to sort of provide more shorthand for past regrets and for somebody who'd escaped a life of violence in a more explicit way than was evident in the book, where he's just sort of come from a dodgy, sketchy, you know, rough as guts, rural backgrounds. But the other difference is that, you know, we've had to try to find ways, particularly with Maggie, because, I mean, and I know because I've read this in reviews that for some people, likability is an issue when it comes to Maggie. And I do get that because she is a difficult character and she's a character who doesn't necessarily make herself immediately a warm and cuddly presence, I mean, or at all. And I really love her, but I can also see how some of the things that she does can be off-putting to people, particularly when it comes to her leading Simon into danger. And I would argue that in the book, you do get to see her remorse and her regret. You do get to see her really struggling with that choice and with the consequence of that choice. And in future books, you'll see her struggling with that more because that's something that doesn't go away. That's something she's going to live with forever. But in the film, you know, we've had to kind of find ways to make things like that more explicit, you know, to add beats where you can really see that, but see it through action as opposed to seeing it through, you know, internal monologue, because there is no internal monologue. So that's been a really interesting process. And I've got to say that the director of the film, who hopefully will be announced really soon, has been absolutely amazing in terms of like helping me, and I'm not a particularly visual person, helping me kind of find ways to tell the same story in a more visual medium without getting to have the same degree of introspection or internal monologue that I can have in the book.
Yeah, I'm curious to talk more about the film process, if there is anything else that you can discuss with it.
Yeah, well,
obviously there is.
Hit me up with questions.
I suppose, like, in terms of the chronology of it, are you imagining it unfolds in the same kind of back and forth way as the book? And if so, how are you going to distinguish those? This might be too much detail, but yeah.
No, that's okay. It's that's been an ongoing question in terms of how to do it. There was a version of it early on, and this was the same in the book as well, where it wasn't clearly delineated as then and now. It was established as just two parallel storylines, with the half-baked idea in my head being that the reveal that Maggie was the girl in the roadhouse would be as a twist. And, and I'm actually aware that for some readers it has been, because she's never named as Maggie in the present day stuff until about the midpoint of the story where she wakes up. It's funny because I have read a couple of reviews that have alluded to the fact that they found that surprising, that did land as a reveal. So I'm pretty happy with that. But, you know, I really love the idea that, like, it's kind of like the first season of Westworld, you know, when you get to the end, you're kind of like, that character was that character all along. Oh my God. You know, and I kind of wanted that, but it was too contrived to make it work. And so early on the film, I was thinking, well, maybe I can make that work. But basically, one of the executives, I think it was John Berg at Vertigo, was just like, that's going to piss people off. Don't, like, just make it clear from the start. I was like, cool, you know, whatever. I'm trying to be clever, but it's obvious. Yeah, it's not working. So I think at the moment, the way it's been done based on the storyboards and based on my conversation with the director is that there'll be a big, like, we'll start in the present day, same as the book, and it pretty much follows the same structure, but the first jump, I don't want to spoil like the cool visual choices, but then there are also so many cool visual choices that are being made that this is just one of them. But like, you know, the part where Maggie collapses on the ground, then suddenly it just comes up on screen, like this big then fills the screen, and then you fly through the words into like Simon's road trip. So that's kind of one cool thing. And then a similar thing happens at the end of the first Simon magazine with the now, but that doesn't happen because obviously as the story goes on, particularly with the way the film has been written, the then and now moments alternate. So it's more like we set up, okay, when you're following Simon and Maggie, it's in the past. When you're following Frank and Ali at the roadhouse, it's in the present. And once that's been established through the big kind of full screen intertitles, we're sort of hoping that the audience will just be like, okay, cool, and go with it. So that's kind of, so at the moment it's following like a very, very similar structure, but yeah, like, you know, there's just other changes that, you know, just have to be done to sort of fit the medium. You know, as I said, there are characters who have been cut from the film. There are extra characters who've been added into the film as well. There've been characters whose fates are very different in the film than they are in the book, and vice versa. And ultimately, you know, there's been a couple of choices. I absolutely won't spoil this, but there have been a couple of choices made in the film that I'm looking at and I'm thinking, cool boy, if this works and if this is successful, then, and if, you know, the first film gets made and then more films get made, I am not going to be able to adapt the following books completely the same way, because there are things that have happened that happened currently in the film that actually that are different to what happens in the book that will contradict later books.
Oh,
that won't line up with later books. So that's really interesting, because like I'm totally okay with it, weirdly, because like when the director kind of pitched these ideas to me, I was like, look, ultimately, I don't think you can rob in any story. I don't think you can rob Peter to pay Paul. You know, I don't think you can sort of take away from the story you're currently telling, because you're like, oh, but that's going to pay off down the line, because you might not get a down the line if the current story sucks. You know, I really am a strong believer in making sure that your first story is as good as humanly possible, and then worry about the sequel if and when you get a sequel, you know? So I was fine with those choices, but it is interesting because, you know, the director and I have been kind of talking about how it might end up being that there are two totally, if, and you know, I have to stress the big if both the book and the film are successful enough to warrant further excursions into this world, then it might end up being one of those things where there just are two completely different parallel Maggie sagas going on at the same time, because, so you know, cool. Like, for example, particularly my idea for the final book has been greatly compromised by some of the choices in the film, which to me is really exciting because it makes me go, okay, cool. So how am I going to, you know, if we do get there, how do I make up the difference? So I have no idea yet, but I kind of like it. It's really exciting to me to have these sort of two alternate versions of the same story that ultimately best serve their own respective mediums.
What do you think will be the scene you're most looking forward to seeing in the movie?
Oh, the scalping. 100% the scalping.
Heck yes.
Like, it's gotta be the scalping. I mean, there's so many, and like, it's been really cool because I've seen the first 40 minutes of the film have been animated through like animated storyboards,
cool.
Like to music, yeah. And to sound effects and everything. So watching that has given me like a really, like, obviously it's not the same as like seeing it with actors and everything, but has given me a really clear idea of what the director's vision is and how the film's going to look and move. And what I can say, and you know, I need to stress, so, you know, like all the necessary forces are working to make this happen. So, you know, just to stipulate it, you know, I'm really hoping it does and it's looking like it will, but nothing's a sure thing until it's a sure thing, particularly in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But what I will say is, based on that animatic and based on what I've seen and based on what the director's work has been so far, this film is going to be so good. Like, it's just the visual choices, the stylistic nature of what I've seen so far, the like clever little ways of the clever little visual storytelling methods that are being employed to make this happen. And also like the director's total understanding of the heart of the story, you know, all of these things that we're talking about the elements that give, that lend The Hunted more depth than hopefully lend The Hunted more depth than your standard run of the mill kind of horror thriller story, are completely understood by the team on board. And I'm so, so confident that the film, fingers crossed, if it happens, will be just a really fantastic visual encapsulation and sort of alternate version of this story told with my enthusiastic blessing, because I just think it's going to be so good. I just think like we have exactly the right person on board to make this happen. And I think they're doing the most incredible job.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. And like even the fact that the book is, yeah, very filmic in nature. It's short, it's really fast paced, and it has such a great visual quality to it as well. Do you know, I don't know if you can give this as a detail, but are you planning to film in Australia, or like what's the...
So one thing that's kind of been really interesting is that obviously with the lockdown thing happening, which is all starting to lift at the time of recording, things are lifting in Australia sooner than they are lifting in other parts of the world, which in some ways I think has kind of made The Hunted more of an appealing prospect for a lot of the creatives involved, because this film can in theory be made a lot quicker than a lot of the other films that are on the slate of the same companies, because it can be made entirely in Australia.
Mm.
So it will be, yeah, the film will be unquestionably Australian. It's going to have all those same themes about what it is to be Aussie, what it is to be, you know, all of those things are going to be in there because it will be filmed here. In terms of where it will be filmed, I don't yet know. There's been a couple of different locations that have been mooted and, you know, that's an ongoing discussion. But basically, look, at the moment, it's once the casting is confirmed, and particularly the casting of Frank and Maggie, those are sort of the two characters who they're really locking down now. And there are some really, really exciting conversations going on with some absurdly talented people who, like, you know, when, like, yeah, it's you like, I am still having trouble believing who these people are. But if those conversations go as positively as I hope they're going, then once that's locked, then everything else I think will fall into place really quickly. But again, you know, you just don't know. Like, it, you know, so many things could happen between now and then. And obviously, as this year has proved so far, things are madly unpredictable. So, you know, who knows at this point?
You recently shared a clip on Twitter of you performing a Oscar-worthy scene from Jaws. Will we be seeing any of your acting in The Hunted?
Okay, so the bit, one of my requests has been, you know, the bit when, I mentioned it before, when Frank blows up the roadhouse. And what I've written in the script is that the guy who's pouring the petrol under the door with a petrol nozzle is like just this bloke sitting there whistling as he's pouring petrol, and then suddenly the flames race up the petrol nozzle and blow him away. I've asked, can I be that guy? Like, yes. I just want to be that guy. I don't want a speaking role. Like, I'm too invested in this film doing well to try to subject anybody to my acting. But
your acting is quality, yeah. Man. That American accent and Jaws.
Yeah, that was good fun. But I wouldn't, as anybody who sat through my performance in Dracula: Last Voyage of the Demeter a few years ago, when I thought that I was doing a really passable impression of like Benedict Cumberbatch crossed with Alan Rickman, then I listened to the radio play recording later and I was like, no, I just sound really Australian. And I was trying to sound like the two most British men in the world. And I just sound like more Aussie than I sound
in my
actual
life. What is this
Bogan
doing in this?
Yeah, I know, right? Anyway. So no, I won't be. I would love to be in it just briefly as somebody who dies horribly. But I'm not going to be like, I 100% would not subject anybody to sitting through me actually trying to speak. I'm not, as much as I love Quentin Tarantino, I'm not going to do that to people. I'm not going to do his old trick.
That would be so great if you would be the petrol pourer in that scene.
I would love it so much.
That would be great. It just seems like the movie is such a dream come true from the... I mean, obviously, you know, like, it's still early days and everything, but it just seems like it's so, like, after, you know, like, how quickly you've gone from publishing Boone Shepherd to having, you know, these moments. And were there any moments within that kind of... within your writing journey? Because I know it's obviously not an overnight success thing. It's a... you know, well over a decade that you've been writing. Were there any moments that you kind of felt like sluggish or not motivated to write? And was there anything that got you through those in particular?
There's been a lot of those moments. And really, the only thing that ever really got me through was just, you know, because there've been so many moments where like I haven't really had a story to work on. You know, I haven't really had something that's like passionately engaging me. And that's kind of something I've been going through recently as well, is just like not really having something that's, I've got a lot of things that I've got to get finished for like, you know, pre-existing commitments, but I haven't really had like a new thing that I've been really excited by. And, you know, and I guess I'd sort of have to just trust in experience there and be like, that's happened a lot in the past. And ultimately, whenever it has happened, I just have to trust that the story I want to tell next will come along when it comes along. It always does. But you know, that like the other thing is like writing, feeling sluggish about your writing is one thing, but you know, writing can be demoralizing on a couple of levels because, you know, sometimes you sit there. I mean, I think, was it Thomas Harris wrote in one of his interviews where he talks about how sometimes you turn up, you sit at the desk and you wait and they just don't turn up. You know, the characters don't turn up. The story doesn't turn up. And what do you do then? There's nothing you can do. You know, you can try to force yourself through it. And sometimes I think if you force yourself, you'll eventually get into a rhythm where it'll start coming more naturally. But other times you're just forcing yourself to write stuff on the page. And if you're sitting there feeling like you're making it up, then it often just means that it's not really organic and it's not really coming from anywhere. Mm. It's just nonsense that you've put together. But you know, the other thing, of course, is that, you know, like professional setbacks can be hugely demoralizing. That can really, and you know, I've been lucky in that for the last little while, I haven't had any huge egregious professional setbacks. You know, my professional career is kind of taken off in really exciting ways in the last 12 months across the board in pretty much every department. But, you know, before that, I had some real massive professional setbacks. I had, like, I've written in blogs and stuff about how in 2018, you know, I had a succession of big things that kind of fell through all around the same time and left me with no kind of clear path forward or no project to really feel optimistic about. And I don't think I realized until I look back in retrospect, like, how big a toll that took on me and sort of how, in what a bad place that sort of left me. But, you know, that's also the thing where it's like, I say that and I'm like, I don't want to sound like I'm sitting here being like, you know, bemoaning my horrible circumstances, because, you know, ultimately it's a career that I chose myself and that's the nature of the beast. And that just is writing, unfortunately. You know, you can't just sit there and expect that everybody is going to recognize your incredible genius, because they're just not going to. You know, you have to make sure that you're writing stuff that's good enough or at least attention grabbing enough that people do sit up and say, okay, there is something here. And, you know, that, so I really do believe that, like, writers in general just can't let that stuff get to them. And if you do find yourself feeling sluggish for whatever reason, or you just feel like you're unmotivated or whatever, then you just have to find whatever tool is possible to get yourself out of that funk, whether it's just waiting for it to come back, but knowing it will come back, or whether it's sitting down and forcing yourself to do something, or whether it's doing writing exercises, or whether often I find that just like watching a really good TV show or reading a really good book can have a huge impact on me, because it kind of reinvigorates me and makes me go, this is why I love doing this. Now I want to do more of this. So, you know, there's, it's different for everyone. You know, I'm always kind of loath to sort of, no, I say I'm always loath to, but it's literally what I do in my blog all the time. But like, I guess I feel resistant about sort of handing out any explicit writing advice, because I just think it's a process that's so different from everyone. I think I've got a lot of ideas about making a career as a writer, but when it comes to the actual writing process and what's good for people in terms of, you know, what's good for you as a writer individually, that's just so different to everyone. You know, nobody has the same journey.
It really comes back to self-awareness in that regard.
Yeah, it really does, I think.
You mentioned before that you have been thinking a little bit about the final book within the Maggie series. What is your kind of vision for this series? And I suppose, I know you're on a 2-book deal with HarperCollins at the moment, so again, it's still up in the air to some extent, but what do you kind of, in an ideal world, hope that Maggie's series would be saying or exploring or turning out to be?
Yeah, it's, look, one thing I will say first and foremost is that the biggest lesson I think I learned from the Boone Shepherd books, and I learned a lot from the Boone Shepherd books, and I remain very proud of the Boone Shepherd books, but the biggest lesson I learned from the Boone series was, particularly with the first Boone Shepherd, I ended that book on a massive cliffhanger, which in retrospect was profoundly arrogant, because it basically was me assuming I was going to get a second, a third, and at the time, a fourth as well. And then the first book, as I've said before, did well, and obviously did well enough to justify 2 sequels. But for a while there, it didn't look like that was necessarily going to be the case. Mm. And that left me sitting there thinking, if there's not a second book, then I've just left with a big Boone Shepherd will return to be continued, massive cliffhanger, yeah. And that's the end. And that left me sitting there thinking, okay, like, you're never guaranteed a sequel. Like, you are never guaranteed a sequel. And it's so funny, because I have writers who come to me for advice and say, look, I'm planning a 3-book series. I'm like, can you tell it in one book? If you can tell it in one book, tell it in one book. Trust me, just do it. Like, particularly if you're going for traditional publishing where, you know, the money it makes is a huge factor. You just, like, if you can do it in one, do it in one. So that's why when I wrote the second Boone Shepherd book, I made sure that it ended in a conclusive place, even though it didn't obviously resolve the story I wanted to resolve. I made sure that at least if that was the last one, it didn't leave the characters in a massive cliffhanger in the same way. So when it came to writing the Maggie series, I was very adamant that every book was a total standalone. So to me, it's really important that you can read these books in any order, that it doesn't matter where you start. If you read them in order, you'll sort of see the arc. But, you know, I basically want to write a series of standalone thrillers where every book is Maggie ending up in a different situation, told chronologically, where, you know, the literal and figurative scars of the previous adventures do come back. Like, they are relevant and they do matter. But, you know, for example, you're not really going to see Frank and Allie again, for example. You know, you're not really going to see any of the surviving characters in The Inheritance again. You know, the characters will sort of be there. They'll turn up. Some of them might reappear down the line. I don't really have a strict rule on that. But, you know, I really want to feel like at the end of every book, Maggie rides off into the sunset. And if that's the last time you see her, that's the last time you see her. You know, if that's the last time you see her, there's nothing, there's no huge hanging loose end that will really make you be like, oh, that's annoying. And I mean, like I've noticed in some reviews or some commenters online have been talking about how they're like, oh, you don't find out where Maggie's money came from in The Hunted. And I was a bit like, oh, don't you? Because I thought it was pretty explicit that she stole it from her father. But then I'm like, I actually think that that line was cut in editing somewhere along the line.
I don't recall reading it either, yeah.
Yeah, okay, right. Well, all right. There's me on the record saying that she stole her money from her father before she killed her father. So I don't think that was explicit. But anyway, that is all explained in the second book anyway. So that's me saying, I say there's no loose ends, but I think there is an accidental loose end, which I'm now trying to explain. But yeah, I really want The Hunted to feel completely like a standalone story with the beginning, middle, and an end. I wanted The Inheritance to be the same. I'm halfway through writing a draft of the third book at the moment, which I definitely want to feel the same. But the other thing is that I want all of them to be really different. You know, I don't want anybody to feel like I'm writing the same book 20 times over. So while The Hunted is kind of a horror thriller, sort of outback noir story, The Inheritance is more like a crime thriller, like an Elmore Leonard crime thriller. The third book is almost like the Da Vinci Code, like an Australian Da Vinci Code, but like one that jumps around in time. My idea for the fourth book is like full-on gothic horror, like set over one night, full-on gothic horror. I've got an idea for the fifth one, which is like a straight-up Western. Like just a full-on isolate, like straight up middle of nowhere Western.
Nice.
And that's kind of as far as I've got. You know, I've got a very clear idea of what the final book will be. But what I don't know is how many books it will take me to get to the final book. You know,
right.
I mean, if The Hunted comes out and does okay, and if The Inheritance comes out and does okay, and then HarperCollins are like, we probably don't want another one, which I don't know if that is a thing that happens or not, but that might happen. And if it does, then I don't want the audience to feel like they've only got a small chunk of the story. I want them to feel like, okay, well, we've got two complete stories here. And if that's all there is, that's all there is. But if I can keep telling stories about Maggie, then I'm going to keep telling stories about Maggie. But I also know, as I learned with Bryn Shepherd, that there will be an end to the journey. And I think I know what the end is, but I'm aware that that end might change. It definitely did in the case of Bryn Shepherd. But ultimately, if I can tell a series of thrillers that are all standalones, are all vastly different in terms of genre, but ultimately chart a coherent through-line narrative for this character, which in my mind is kind of a journey of moral reckoning of a character who has come from a horrible, loveless background, slowly learning to come back into touch with her own humanity in some ways, but then there'll be complications along that journey in a lot of ways. And, you know, this is where I'll probably hold back because I don't want to spoil too much about where I want to go with it. But I don't want Maggie to be Jack Reacher. You know, she's not going to be the same character in every single book. You know, there is a really clear journey I want to take her on. There is a really clear arc I have in my head for her, but I want to write it in such a way that, as I said, it won't feel incomplete if you only read one or two books in that story, you know?
Yeah, I think that's such an important point to underscore. I mean, I almost felt that a little bit with myself recently. I was, as you said, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to write a 7-book fantasy series. And I got to the end of the first draft of one and I was like, crap, this really doesn't work if you just stop reading here. And I don't know if people are going to have the patience to continue. So I decided to then go into something where it could be more standalone with each book while still having some sort of arc.
And that's the thing, yeah. I always point people to A New Hope, you know. And it struck me a few years ago when I rewatched A New Hope, and I was like, oh, if you watch this film by itself and you didn't know that there was a whole franchise around it, it is a perfectly satisfying, complete story with a beginning, middle, and an end. I mean, yeah, they don't defeat the Empire, but they blow up the Death Star. They destroy the main villains that we've seen. Like, you know, it can be assumed that they go on to defeat the Empire. Like, you don't need more. And it was only when A New Hope became hugely successful that it was kind of retroactively made into Episode 4 and part of this bigger story. But don't end it on the matter. If you don't get that second book, then you're the one who looks like an idiot, you know?
Absolutely. And I think Matrix is a good example of that as well. Like, first movie is incredibly standalone. And then arguably you could say that maybe it's an example of a slightly less good interpretation in the second and third movie, although they're still do have a really satisfying arc when you look at them from like a very macro level. But yeah, it's just such an important thing to, like, I think as well, to be able to convince readers that you can stick the landing and to give them a satisfying end.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, you know, I've been somebody who has constrained myself. I'm not going to do this, or I'm not going to do this. If I ended up in a position down the line where I was regularly selling enough, had enough to like Game of the Wind or a Lord of the Rings or, you know, big multi-story that explicitly is in multiple parts. And I'm not ruling that out, not for a second. But I guess what I would say is that for now, at this point in my career, I feel more comfortable making every book I write the best it possibly be as a standalone, whether or not it's part of a bigger... I mean, you know, my writing is probably Tana French, and you look at all of her books, even though her first six books are a series, and there are thematic preoccupations that are through all of them, and there is a through the series in terms of flaws and the different ways it dealt with what it is to be a detective. They are all standalone. You can read all of them by themselves and you don't need to read the others. And if you do, or you can in any order and you'll still have a great time. But if you read them in the order in which they're written, read all of them, you'll have a more complete experience. And that's pretty much what I'm going for with the Maggie books.
Makes a lot of sense. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask a couple of quick questions about your kind of writing process in general. I know you mentioned that you don't like to give prescriptive writing advice, but I think it's always useful to just see how other authors do their thing. And in particular, you know, if anything has changed since last time we've talked about your writing. So how do you structure your day as a writer? You work full-time as a writer. What does your current writing routine look like? And how have you managed to, yeah, I suppose, just balance everything that you need to do within the job of being a full-time author?
I tend to follow I always have a to-do list that I sort of set up for every day. And that includes just like, you know, general things I do in the morning, different bits and pieces. And, you know, I always make time to read a little bit and watch a little every day. But of course, the bulk of the day has to be put over to writing work. So part of my days at the moment, like I sort of go through my morning stuff and then I sit down at my desk and then I sort of look over the work I've got to do. Get up to make a cup of tea, go to the jigsaw puzzle that's on the table, and then I spend an hour at the jigsaw puzzle, and then I go, oh crap, I've got to write. Then I go back and sit down, then I sit there and I read over what I was supposed to be working on, and then I go, oh, I have a cup of tea. Then I go back to the cup of tea, then suddenly it's 2 hours later, I'm still working on the jigsaw puzzle. Then I go back to the desk, and then maybe I write 100 words, and then I realize that it's 5 o'clock and it's time to have a beer. So moments, but I think that's probably a symptom of the whole isolation thing more than anything else. It's also a symptom of the fact that, like, at the time of speaking, I'm working TV series at the moment for a big company, which is really great. It's like, it's been awesome, like financially in an awesome big job. And I'm really excited about it. At the moment, I don't think I can send a pilot that's getting quite a bit of buzz. And now I'm writing a Bible for it. And that is proving for the last few I have of telling I'm gonna have to you tomorrow, and then tomorrow it's not ready yet. Look, honestly, it's like I don't upset writing process like day by day. I wish I did, but like I try to write something every day, but I used to beat myself up if I didn't write 1,000 words a day. You know, if I didn't write at least 1,000 words every day, I would beat myself up. Whereas nowadays, I'm just so much more aware of the fact that, like, I've got so many responsibilities in terms of, you know, not only do I have the TV, the film stuff, I've got Hunted, I've got my theater work, and then I've got other bits and pieces sort of bubbling along in the background. And, you know, and a lot of these things exist I have to find time to write new things as well, because if I don't write new things, then I'm not going to kind of be able to sustain the career that I want to sustain. So I'm really trying to like regiment my time to pick things up and say, hey, today I'm going to work on this, today I'm on this. And you know, I have good writing, I have bad writing days. And I have days where I write easily and it'll be totally effortless. Other days where I struggle to get 500 out, you know? And I think for a while there, I prided myself on being prolific and I'm writing lots every day. But I've also realized recently that holding myself to a standard is a force myself to write 1,000 words or more every day, then a lot of the time 1,000 words are just going to be crap and unusable. So, you know, I guess I just sort of read that Thomas Harris interview and I think, okay, I'm going to make myself write at least a little bit. The project it is that I have to, you know, as the closest deadline, I guess. And to move, you know, if it starts to kind of flow clearly, I'll sit down and I'll write quite a bit. And if it doesn't, then, you know, I guess I'll come back another day, because some projects don't flow one day and they'll flow another day. You know, then I guess I've at the moment I've really Lucas Betrayal, for example, which was my radio play project that came out earlier in the year. Like, I wrote that in 3 days last year, and I wrote it because I had a week in which I didn't have anything else due. And I was like, I just need to write something that nothing to do with me, has nothing to do with my this TV project. I need to write something that was totally for me. It had no clear end game, no clear reason to. I was like, I just want to write this. And I'd had the idea in my head for a long time. It was a sequel to an old play. And so I just sort of bounced, met up for the actor who played Robert Stone, the protagonist in both the original play and Lucas Betrayal. I pitched him my, we bounced a couple of things around, and then I went to the pub and I just sat there and I wrote 4,000 words. Then I wrote another 4,000 words. I went the next day and wrote another one, and that was it. And then I finished, I was like, there it is. And I passed, they recorded as a radio, did a live read, and that was it. And like, that was really exhilarating because project that wasn't for anything, and that I think is my biggest struggle at the moment, is like to keep writing things that like aren't for paperwork or aren't for anything except me, because Lucas Betrayal I only wrote because I want to write that. And that kind of writing something that was purely for passion kind of reinvigorated me for writing everything else. And it's not to say that my other work is, I'm not passionate about my other work, of course I am. But at the moment writing becomes a job, you know, it just, you ultimately, you just need to still write other things, jobs, things that are just hobbies, things that are just fun and that you just exist because they do. So I'm having fun with a couple of those projects, but it's just so funny nowadays how like even those projects can blow up. Like a few weeks ago, I got the mate of my actor who's part of my production company, and I said to him, hey, what if we make a web series in isolation? Like, and the whole premise was, you know, we can get together a few talented actors, a few talented writers, we can write this series. And the whole idea is that it's a girl who's been living in Germany for years, and the first episode is she gets a Skype call from her brother. She hasn't spoken to her brother in a while, and her brother kind of, they've got this really awkward relationship, and you're not really sure what's going on with them. And about halfway through the call, she sort of admits to him that she's been 2 years, and he's sort of really, and he's like, oh wow, you know, that's amazing. Okay, look, anyway, I've got to tell you, the real reason I called you is that your ex-boyfriend's gone missing. And she's like, what do you mean he's gone missing? And she's like, yeah, she's gone missing, I'm just gonna tell you, and I don't want you to be looking into this, I don't want you to upset his family, you know why you shouldn't talk to them, just leave it, you know what happened in the past, just leave it. She goes, yeah, okay, I'll leave it. Anyway, I've got to go to work, all of that. He hangs up, he picks up the bottle of scotch he's had off camera and swigs. And that was the idea I had. And I wrote a pilot episode that could be done just entirely like we're doing now, you know, just like filmed on Zoom, recorded, just get some good actors to do it. And this is what I've got. I'm doing this for fun. And I said to my mate, like, why don't we just make this? Like, everyone's isolating. Every talented actor we know isn't in right now. I've got writers who want to do it. Let's just do it. So we thought, yep, let's do 8 episodes. We're getting a bunch of actors we wanted. You know, it was a fun project. I got really passionate about it for a few days. I still am, but like, I was really just kind of like, this is going to be the best thing ever. And then it just like, it just snowballed. Like, it just became this huge thing. We got a mad, like insanely good director on board. The episode ballooned from like 6 or 8 to like 16. Thing we knew, we had a major production company who came in and optioned it. And now like it's doing the rounds in LA as we speak, and it's like, oh yeah. So that went very quickly from like a fun kind of, hey, this will be like a fun hobby project, to like, oh, now this is work as well. So you know, just that kind of, which that probably sounds like a humble brag or even just a brag, and it's not meant to be. It's more just saying that like the thing is that like when writing becomes your job, and like what you do for fun, still do it for fun, like what you do for fun and what you do for work are still the same thing. And then you kind of come up with something that you really like, and then you sort of put it to some of the content, it can just quickly become, and then you sort of find time to work on things as much as, like, it's weird. It's a different way of approaching writing than I've ever done it before, but it's, I guess, what you have to do the moment it paid work.
That is so cool. Cause yeah, I saw some early tweets about that web series, and I was waiting for it, and then like things sort of went quiet, and then yeah, oh, that's insanely cool that it's blowing up. And I suppose, yeah, it is super topical, and there are probably tons of people who would, yeah, really relate to that experience and to, yeah, all of the, I suppose, conflicts that isolation has brought out and everything. How have you been coping within isolation?
Oh, I've been fine. It's just, it's a weird one because like, I guess it's just not that different to my normal way of living because I work from home anyway. So like, I mean, I've liked it, you know, I'm lucky that with, like, I live with my partner in a few houses, and we, you know, we all have a really, so, I mean, you know, I think we're curdled a little bit. Like, the the jokes have just become progressively worse. And, you know, we've sort of fallen into having a lot of the same conversations again and again. But, you know, we've been watching a lot of movies. I've been reading a lot. And, you know, I pretty much have just had my daily routine. You know, I take my dog for a walk. I, you know, do my writing. I try to make sure I read and think every day. But I miss pubs. You know, I'm a pub writer. I really like going out somewhere and sitting there and writing. Like, you know, I'm out of writing in like grimy old pubs. For some reason, there's just like a, I don't know if it's like a sad permeates the air or something that like I just feed on. I don't know if it's a horrible thing to say. Like, I my writing is going to get better when I can write elsewhere again, in a cafe or like, I think in the scheme of things, I've always done most of my writing out of the house. So to be in a position where I have to do it all in the house probably hasn't been that great for creativity. But, and also I just don't think you get inspired when you're sort of seeing the same things again and again, but I love puzzles. So that's been my, you know, my biggest escape time, but no, it's been all right. Like, you know, and I say that as somebody who, you know, is unquestionably one of the lucky ones in that, you know, I'm still in work from home. It hasn't impacted life enormously, but like, there are so many people who I know who, particularly in the arts, who have, you know, really been impacted by this and really, you know, it's kind of seen. I don't want to sort of turn this into a COVID discussion because we've heard enough about it, but sobering and really horrible to see kind of the impact it's having on a lot of people, particularly in our industry. Like, it's really, it's really, really rough, and particularly for booksellers. And, you know, booksellers have done an amazing job kind of keeping active and delivering, making sure that people are having access to things that they can read and things to keep them entertained. And, you know, it's inspiring really for people. And I don't want to say that horrible word, unprecedented, but the fact of it is, you know, none of us have ever been through this before.
Yeah, I mean, it has, yeah, definitely been an interesting time. And I suppose, yeah, as creatives, we are fortunate in a lot of ways. I suppose getting towards the end of this conversation now, I want to take you back to Boone Shepherd here, because I don't know if I've heard you this before, but inside, I have your signature here.
Hey!
I bought this
there
book.
There I am.
Yeah, that's your signature. I bought it when I was on exchange in London and I saw a Sans Pants radio play in Birmingham and they had copies of your book here. And this was the last copy that they sold on the tour. So.
Ah, that's awesome. That. But, there you go.
Yeah, it's like, it's pretty cool to think that like in this came out in, I think it was 2016. When you were signing your signature in this book, did you think that you would be where you are at now with your writing?
But I think I hoped I would be, is probably the best way to put it. I think I hoped I would be here, but I also didn't know what here would look like. You know, I mean, I always wanted the big book deal and I wanted the film deal and I wanted the things that every writer wants, really, even if they say they don't. But I don't know that I always indulge in a comfortable level of delusion that I would get there. But if you really ask me in like my darkest moments, like in my heart of heart, did I believe I would get here? I don't know that I did. I hoped I would, and I think I worked towards it. But I think on some level, part of me always suspected it was kind of a pipe dream that would never really happen. But no, I mean, I hoped for it and I worked for it and I definitely, you know, applied everything I had to getting there. So I'm really proud that I am, but I don't know that in those early days, I ever really believed I would, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. Gabe, this has been an amazing chat. It's been very inspiring for me and it's been great to have such a deep dive into The Hunted. I will, before I close this out, I'll give everyone links to The Hunted and your website and anything. Is there anything else that you want to close on or discuss as we finish up this?
No, not really. I think we've covered, I mean, it's always so weird because, you know, you think, oh yeah, spoiler filled chat, you know, I'm going to dive deep into everything. And then it's sort of the cover of things. Like, I don't really know what else. And I'm sure that like tomorrow I'll be like, oh crap, I should have spoke about that. But no, I think we covered heaps and, you know, like, I mean, I'm always available on Twitter and stuff. If people, you know, want to express their outrage about the book, talk about killing off this character or that character or whatever. So I'm always totally, totally cool to have those conversations. And you know, like, yeah, please just like, if you've read the book, like, let me know, send me a tweet, send me an email, anything. I'm just always excited to hear that anybody's read it, whether you liked it or didn't like it, you know, at the end of the day.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much for this chat, Gabe. This has been wonderful. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me again, Jed.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. I had a blast doing this interview with Gabe. I always love talking with him, and he is an amazing communicator, really passionate and self-aware about his writing. Always a pleasure to talk to. If you haven't already read The Hunted, I would highly recommend picking it up. And if you have read The Hunted and you enjoyed it, you may be interested in my own novel, Fires of the Dead. Fires of the Dead is a fantasy novella, a number one bestseller on Amazon in the fantasy adventure fiction category. And it's been described as the perfect read for someone looking to be immersed in a magic system unlike anything else. So it's not a thriller like The Hunted, but it does have a lot of the thrilling, pulse-pounding aspects of The Hunted. It's about Wisp, a magician who draws energy from fires to make his own flames. Leading a misfit thieving crew, he enters a desolate wasteland to steal a dead sorcerer's skull. But his crew aren't the only ones on the hunt, and the forest isn't as barren as it seems. So Fires of the Dead, it's a grimdark fantasy novella, and if you're looking for something that has that same really fast-paced, twisting plot as Gabriel Bergmose's The Hunted, I highly recommend that you give it a crack. So thank you so much for listening to this. If there was anything particularly interesting that you'd learned from this interview, any different approaches to writing, or just thoughts that this conversation gave you, let me know on Twitter. You can reach me at Jed Hearn, that's J-E-D-H-E-R-N-E, or you can reach Gabriel Bergmoser on his Twitter at GoBergmoser. The links to that are in the show notes if you want to check out spellings, along with the links to Gabe's books and his website, so you can check out all of that in the show notes for this. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Now go and write extraordinary stories. I'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.